Welcome back, WNST, Towson Baltimore and Baltimore Positive. We are positively getting the Maryland Crab Cake Tour back out on the road just in time for baseball season. And I'm wearing my Fadley's gear because we're going to be down at Fadley's on the 7th, which is the day after opening day, the home opening day, because we open on the road. And also that week, we're going to be on the 5th over with our friends at Costas celebrating 50 years of the Maryland Lottery. It's 50th anniversary. I'll have some instant lottery scratch-offs to give away. Also, our friends at Win Donation, 866-90-NATION. Call while you can. You buy two, you get two free. 24 months, 0% financing with our friends at Win Donation. And for our friends at Fadley's, I just want to throw this out. We're going to be doing that the morning of the Springsteen show that opens the new arena. And then the Eagles are in on Saturday. So it's a whole downtown thing. We'll be talking about downtown, the old Lexington Market, the new Lexington Market. Just a reminder, you can stop by Fadley's on the way to the ballpark, get the best crab cakes going, delicious beer, three blocks away from Camden Yards. So come on downtown and do it. This one is really after my heart. I honestly, y'all know my baseball thing for 31 years and season starts, and a lot of the writers have changed, although I'm expecting Bob Ryan and Dan Shaughnessy to show up here this week as we play the Red Sox and some of my Yankees friends. But I'm always looking for good baseball conversations to have and honest ones about the history of the game. And this one kind of came to me. Fella has written a book about the 1973 season. Now, that's interesting to me for a lot of reasons, not just because it's 50 years ago. And I was one of the guys that dumped the DH bumper stickers back in 1991 when this whole journey started on the radio. But 73 is sort of my first year that I remember baseball. I was 4 years old, going to be five. My cousin's playing for the Red Sox. I was a baseball fan and all of that stuff. So this guy has some show and tell about his book. I have some show and tell about the 1973 baseball season that I have fetched out of my attic of baseball troves. You know, John, they put the bunting out, and I get crazy about opening day. And the Orioles, like, have a chance this year, which is very, very rare since I hit puberty. John Rosengren is here. His book is now out. You can buy it. He'll be holding it up. They gave me the PDF, and that's good for me. But, John, I got to tell you, man, page 202, there's a picture of Luis Aparicio and Orlando Cepeda. So the greatest summer in baseball history. Now, I've heard that about 67, 68. Around here, we think it's 83 or 70 or 66. But I know you're a big 73 fan. So welcome in, man. Let's talk some baseball, my friend.
Hey, Nestor. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Well, books and 73. I don't know how old you were in 73. I've already given away that I was born 4 days after the 68 World Series ended, which was during the riots in Detroit, 1968. So I was a war-torn baby to begin with. But in 73, I remember Rusty Staub. I remember the playoffs. The Oakland A's were the first team I ever hated, and I've admitted that a whole lot. And you're wearing that A's hat that had Reggie Jackson, Sal Bando, Campy Catfish, Vita Blue, Blue Moon Odom, all the guys that my dad hated and taught me how to hate. But 73 was really special to me. The baseball cards of 73 and 74 and 75, even the minis, were special to me. Why 73 for you?
Good question. There are two reasons. One, to reference the age, I hit that sweet spot in 1973 between the time when a kid learns how to read a box score and discovers dating. And so the time was magical for me right then. That's, I think, the golden era of sports in any kid's life who grows up.
Listen, 31 years I've been saying this on the air. Baseball was the greatest thing in the world until I discovered girls. And I'm talking like Charlie's Angels, Cheryl T, you know, right around then, you know, it was right around disco, right around all of that. So, yes, changed me. Raquel Welch's passing hit me the wrong way as well. So, yes.
Right. But until then, it seems that sports captivates our attention and our imagination. And we're in that young period of our lives where we dream and our imaginations are vivid. And so it's a magical time to follow sports. I turned 9 the summer of 1973. And so it was right in that sweet spot for me, as I said. And then I was looking for, I knew I wanted to write a book about a year in the history of baseball. And I was looking for one that had significance, both in the nation's profile, but also in the game itself. And I think I found it in 1973. I mean, we had the U.S. sign the Paris Peace Accords and started pulling out of Vietnam. there was the oil shortage and gas was hard to come by. Watergate was unraveling and Nixon was tap dancing around that. The Watergate hearings had begun. And so it was this time, the American Indian Movement had taken over Wounded Knee. So Marlon Brando refused his Oscar.
The Padres were trying to move to Washington and they printed baseball cards in the spring and screwed that all up, right?
Right. And then with the baseball season, your cousin had a new teammate in Orlando Cepeda, who was the first man hired as a designated hitter. The American League had embarked on this 3-year experiment starting in 1973 with what Charlie Finley called the permanent pinch hitter. And then George Steinbrenner bought the Yankees. And so there's this infusion of money into the game. Hank Aaron was trying to catch Babe Ruth and his fabled 714 career home run mark, and did that with all sorts of racist resistance in the country, which reflected the times, of course. I mean, the most popular TV show at the time was All in the Family with Archie Bunker, America's favorite bigot. And then we had the Mets and the A's going after it in the World Series. And Willie Mays, who had been traded late in his career in 72 from the Giants to the Mets, was in the last legs of his career. And Reggie Jackson was up and coming with the A's. It was his first World Series. And there was this passing of the torch of superstars. And Reggie Jackson really, you know, Willie Mays, I think, defined the superstar of his era. And Reggie Jackson redefined the superstar with the chest thumping, ego maniac, hype talking player who could actually back that up. And so it was a transformative time in the game. I would maintain that it's never been the same. There's kind of a pre-73 era and a post-73 era.
Well, 68 and the ERAs and dead ball that begat the designated hitter. And then, of course, 73 with free agency, right? I mean, Messersmith, you're right on the precipice of all of that was about to happen, where the Oriole way was about, let's get Don Baylor, let's get Bobby Grich, let's get Doug DeCinces, let's get all the guys that would later go play for the California Angels, right? Or the New York Yankees. You know, all of that was moving. And when I think of 73, you know, my dad took me to those playoff games in 73 and 74, specifically 74 with Catfish and Jim Palmer. I remember that game. I still have my scorecard from that era and those games. But 73... There were the incidents with Pete Rose and Harrelson, right? And there was there was also Rusty Staub was a great player, you know, leaving Montreal but coming to the Mets. I mean, he was on the other side of the 69 Mets, right? That the Mets really were going to challenge the Yankees, right? The Mets started as a joke, but second time they've been in the World Series and the Yankees were in the outhouse, literally at that point, right? The Yankees were a mess.
Yeah, the Yankees had gone into decline when CBS bought them, and they their glory days looked like they might be over. And, you know, you talk about the change in – well, the free agency, actually, the context for that was there had been a strike in 1972 that shortened the season. And then in 73 – there was a lockout at spring training because the players and the owners were working out the basic agreement, which spelled out things like minimum wage and World Series shares, et cetera.
Well, the designated hitter got them jobs, right? It gave Cepeda, Tommy Davis, you know, it gave jobs to players and has for 50 years, literally, right?
Right. What I
want to say, Edgar Martinez, is a career, Harold Baines,
agency,
right?
Was that when there were these labor disputes. And it had soured the fans. And so attendance was down, particularly in the American League. And so that set the stage for free agency. The big gain in 1973 was arbitration, where the players could name a salary figure that they thought that they deserved. Management named a figure they thought that was fair. And then an arbitrator picked one and went with it. So it gave the players negotiating power, leverage in their contract negotiations, which was new. And yes, the DH rule did give players like Orlando Cepeda a chance to extend their careers. He had retired. The A's had actually released him in 72. He thought his career was done.
How many Hall of Famers? Frank Robinson at that point was a DH, right?
Exactly right. Tony Oliva, Rico Carty were some of the big names back then.
The big boy. You mentioned Rico Carty. Yeah. Any show I do with Rico Cardi's mention, any of the protagonists of Seasons in Hell, my favorite baseball book, by the way, which also, by the way, was of that era, right?
Yeah. Right. So anyway, the DH, as I mentioned, the rule was offered as an experiment for 3 years, but it was so successful in bringing fans in the through the turnstiles that after the end of the season, the owners decided, let's go with this. We'll make it a permanent thing. And then, of course, it only took the National League 49 years to catch up last year.
Baseball moves at a glacial pace. The greatest summer in baseball history, how the 73 season changed us forever. Hold the book up. John Rosengren's here from Minnesota. Say something about that book and tell me. So when did it come out? Give me the little background on this while you hold that up.
Okay, so this came out in actually the original book was this book in 2000, it's so hard for me to do.
Hammer and Hank, George Almighty, and the Say Hey Kid. All right.
Yeah. So this came out in 2008. So 15 years ago. And it had one of the worst titles in history of a book publishing industry. And so I was able to convince the publisher to reissue it this year on the 50th anniversary of the 73 season with a new cover, new title. And so here it is.
There it is.
And we picked that the photo of Willie Mays with arguing the call. That was when Buddy Harrelson crossed the plate in the World Series, and he got tagged. Well, Ray Fosse claims he tagged him on the jersey, but it looked for all intents and purposes like he got in safely. And Willie Mays was arguing the case there. Yogi Berra later came out and was arguing with him. But when you talk about the Mets, the interesting thing about their season in 73 was they were actually in last place on August 30th. So it looked like their season was basically over. Like, baseball just wasn't doing anything in New York that summer. But they managed to rally, win the division series against the Reds. That was when Harrelson and Rose had their little dust up at second base. And then they, took the A's to 7 games. I won't, don't want to give the spoiler on that one. But
why the A's hat? Are you an A's fan or were you a Twins fan?
Well, I grew up a Twins fan, but in researching this book, I became the A's were this irascible group of guys. They're like these lovable rascals, I think. And yeah, easy to hate, but also looking back on them and seeing all the foibles and what they went through with their owner, Charlie Finley, you know, how he would meddle with the game, with the team. He'd call, tell the manager who was going to pitch. He tried to get him to shave and then they wouldn't. So he went the other way and he had, encourage them all to grow mustaches. But the players, they fought among themselves, but were united by a common hate of Finley. So it was just such an intriguing team that the history of them, the A's, is what I like.
Oh, I mean, great books have been written on Charlie Finley in recent times, and we've had those authors on, and I am a sucker for the mid-70s. John Rosengren is here, and talking baseball and sort of the roots of my baseball. So I got something. I got Show and Tell. You had your book. Okay. So I went and found this because I had thought about this. And, I can share the picture. Let me find the picture on my Facebook because I was fully not prepared for this, but at least for our audience out there that I can find this picture in 1973 at the end of the year. You can look it up in early September. My dad took me out to meet Luis Aparicio and get a baseball. John will share this right off my Facebook page here. The man on the right with the red cap with the C for Colgate's my pop. That's Luis, obviously. The little guy there is me with the baseball and the really sharp looking sweater. But more than that, John, I still have the baseball. And the baseball is actually signed by the 1973 Red Sox. And you can see Aparicio's signature very prominently, in black. All the other ones were in like blue and they sort of faded. But I think about this 73 Red Sox baseball, all right?
Yeah.
Yastrzemski, Fisk, Tiant, Cepeda, Cecil Cooper's on the ball, Petrocelli's on the ball. I know I'm missing another Hall of Famer. I gave you Yaz, Fisk. There was
Orlando Cepeda.
Cepeda's on the ball, right? Rick Miller. I'm just starting to think of other players of that era. But just Fred Lynn and Jim Rice were not on the ball, although they were both of that era, the next year they would come in, and Burleson and Juan Benitez and those players, Diego Seguí's autographs on this ball, Dick Pohl, Dick Pohl's autographs on this ball. So, so I like as a kid, the 73 season to me is very magical. And I think when you write about it, the DH more than anything that year, I don't remember baseball before the DH. Now, we all do because they played the National League style in the National League for 49 more years, right? But I think the DH thing and my dad's thoughts about it as growing up in Baltimore, where it was sold and embraced by Frank Cashin and Earl Weaver, and, we had Lee May after that, and that in the 70s, it was so controversially weird. And my dad grew up in Scranton, Pennsylvania. My dad was born in 1919. My dad saw Babe Ruth play, right? So my dad was old school, but my dad like embraced the DH as a Baltimore guy as we rode the bus out to Memorial Stadium in the 70s. And my dad liked it from a strategic standpoint, believe it or not. My dad was 55 years old at the time, but my dad liked the DH, that it became something. And that season, when you say change the game of baseball, never the same again in the American League, for sure.
Right. It's interesting you mentioned Carl Yastrzemski, because he was one of the guys who spoke out against the DH, didn't want it to happen. And his concern was if the pitchers didn't have to bat, they wouldn't have to face retribution for throwing at batters on the other team.
Like Don Drysdale, as an example.
Well, Yastrzemski wasn't facing Drysdale, of course, but because he was pitching the National League. But plenty of
guys that had a reputation
were throwing at players. I mean, that was part of baseball's code, but they knew then if they had to, they had come back to bat, they could face the same thing. And so there was actually a study done several years later. It's called the moral hazard. If you can engage in risky behavior without danger of consequence. And they said that it did show, like in the, I think it was 20 years or so after the DH was instituted, that there's an 11 to 17% greater chance that players would get hit.
Well,
there was that, not the, the retribution.
It didn't stop Pedro, but it helped Pedro when he got to the American League.
Pedro Martinez?
Yeah. Well, just the guys of that era that would switch leagues and wouldn't have to bat anymore, and it could change their ability to be aggressive or more aggressive. Of course, that didn't stop the bench clearing brawls. John Rosengren's here. He's written about the 1973 baseball season. I hope you go buy his book. So your connection to baseball these days, I know you're in the Minnesota area. I had Rod Carew on. I did my show. Radio wrote Super Bowl a number of years ago, and his heart is, of course, donated from a former Raven whom I knew in Conrad Rulon. And I think about the twin story in Oliva and Harmon Killebrew. I have another baseball signed by the Killer. My dad took me in 74, maybe 75, down to the Babe Ruth Museum, the Babe Ruth birthplace. The first time I was ever there was to meet Harmon Killebrew. So, I have an affinity for all things that were Mall of America and where there used to be a stadium here, like the Sinatra song and all that, that I would think your childhood with the Twins included some really dog-ass cold baseball in April and May out there.
It did. And then also some hot baseball in July and August. But you're right. Those were the names I grew up with. And Rod Carew was my hero as a kid. I used to argue with my dad, who was a Ted Williams fan, who was the greatest hitter of all time. And he would say, Williams, I said Carew. But that's only because, as I said, it was that magical time when Carew made an impression on me.
My dad were there with you as he would yell about Musial, but my dad loved Ted Williams. I mean, right. Ted, I had the science of hitting. My dad was a nine blocks, all that. Right.
Yeah. And I'm older, I'm willing to concede the argument. Williams could hit with power. Carew couldn't. So Williams was the better hitter.
I got my Tony Gwynn jersey over here. Don't get me started on my buddy Tony now.
I was just in San Diego yesterday, and they're drinking 394 beer there, because that's his season high average. And so there's a brewery, 394.
John, don't give me one more reason to go to San Diego. I don't need.
Well, don't go today. It's raining hard. Another storm coming through.
Beer's cheap, though.
I'll tell you, I have great memories of going to the Met, and of course, they tore out a piece of my heart when they knocked down that stadium and built a shopping mall. And you can still go see. There's a bronze replica of home plate in the center of the mall where there's an amusement park, but it's just so sad. And I remember talking to Harmon Killebrew. They have a chair up on the wall of that in that central area of the amusement park, which was where the longest home run hit in Met Stadium had landed. And that was, of course, Harmon Killebrews. And I asked him, tell me about that home run. How far did it go? And he said, well, it must have been 800 feet. And he said, the older I get, the longer it went. But he was such a gentleman and a good guy. And it was sad. Of course, he ended his career in Kansas City. So we lost him. But Tony Oliva was a guy whose career was extended by the DH rule. You know, he would not be in the Hall of Fame today, I don't think, if the DH rule hadn't come along, because he would have had to retire because of his bad knees. He could no longer play the field. And he'd been a marvelous fielder, but he was obviously known for his hitting, three-time Silver Slugger Award winner, and just a great, great athlete until his knees gave out on him. But anyway, so I have such fond memories of being a boy and going to the game and going to watch the game. And so that's why I think I still – that doesn't go away. That flame doesn't extinguish. And so I still enjoy watching the game. You know, even with the rule changes this year, I think the heart of the game will be the same. And we'll still have that matchup, pitcher batter, and wondering who's going to win and how. And so I'm looking forward to another season with that, the sunshine and the green grass. I mean, to me, that's just an irresistible feeling to be out there on the watching a game as the twilight sets in, you know, and the shadows get long and the grass gets golden under the sunlight. I mean, nowhere else I'd rather be.
Well, you know, for modern fans, and I think about a couple of places like Atlanta, where they played baseball now in three different places. You guys have played in three different places. We're now, don't cough, John, but it's 32 years since Camden Yards kind of was erected, and we're working on a lease, and the old man's kids, you know, got his Nashville boots on and all that. As you're wearing an A's hat, and they don't have anywhere to play. I've been going out right there for years, and I love going to the dump out in Oakland, because it's the only thing left like Memorial Stadium. It's the last stadium that sort of smells like it, looks like it, the bathrooms, the brick, all of it. And Memorial Stadium's been gone almost 30 years now, 25 years. Right. And my wife would tell you it took me 15 years to drive down 33rd Street because it would just break my heart to not even see the stanchions coming up over the trees as you pull into the neighborhood by Montebello. So, I mean, there is something deeply, deeply, I think as we get older, not symbolic, but just even it's part of our life and certainly part of the culture of any city where there was a Major League Baseball team, you know, and if you have those memories of doing that. I'm assuming you have a Homer hanky somewhere there, but more than that, you didn't mention Blylevin. And Blylevin has always pissed me off because he went to Pittsburgh. And then after that, he would come in here every year, do my show. He would make me wear his Pirates World Series ring and sing We Are Family to me and taunt me. But Blylevin was one of my all-time – I mean, did he ever circle you or anything like that? I mean, Bert's a legend in Minnesota, right?
Right. Yeah, I've he figures in my book, in the 1973 book, he was the Twins – he was the pitcher who at 22, he pitched in the All-Star game and took the loss. Unfortunately, he was terribly nervous, walked the first two guys. But yeah, I've been to fantasy camp with Bert Blylevin and talked to him over the years. We actually talked about doing a book together at one point. And what attracted me to him was his stories of practical jokes. I mean, he would crawl in Seattle under the bleachers all the way out to the bullpen in center field to set someone's shoelaces on fire. And the guy just had a great sense of humor. And
Phil does.
Yeah, exactly. So, figures out in this book. But it wasn't until 87 when I think he won the World Series with the Twins that he was, a bigger player here in town.
Well, no doubt my dad knew about the curveball. And, you know, in the mid 70s, it's interesting for all the good teams. And I was a little boy and my dad worked at the steel mill and we would go out, you know, my pop, I showed you the picture. We'd go out to games and he loved baseball, but we were picky about when we would go. And my dad's thing in the 70s was always who's pitching, what's the pitching matchup. And it was never about, do we really want to see Palmer or Cuellar or McNally or, you know, Steve Stone later or Flanagan, those guys. It was more about, hey, when the Angels come in, what night's Nolan Ryan pitching? What night is Tanana pitching? When's Blylevin pitching? When is Splittorff pitching? When is Dennis Leonard pitching? When is, you know, any of the star, we're local people. So when Moose Oss pitched for the Brewers and he's a Baltimore kid, we would want to go see him. But my dad would always do all of that on starting pitching. Where are you on modern era on all of this? Because we've had the pleasure of listening to Jim Palmer bitch for 30 years, not only about really lousy baseball and lousy ownership here, but more than that, about lamenting not just the guys don't go complete games and innings and how many, you know, pitch counts and all of that, but just the fact that the game has changed dramatically from a pitching standpoint. And I don't even know what it means for gambling. They're trying to ram the gambling down our throats here. We're all going to bet on baseball. I've been doing radio 31 years. I've yet to meet the degenerate gambler for baseball that bet on starting pitching, but you can't even do that anymore, really, because it's not, it's viewed differently. The sport views all of its assets so differently in a way that we haven't mentioned analytics yet in 50 years, but boy, has it changed the game.
Right. Well, Jim Ballmer had something to bitch about in 1973. He was would go on to win the Cy Young Award that year, but he was left off the All-Star team by Dick Williams, the manager who was managing the A's at the time. And Nolan Ryan actually figures into the story in 73 because he was added to the All-Star team, but only after Boy Kuhn intervened, because Williams had left Nolan Ryan off the team as well, even though Nolan Ryan had pitched two no-hitters already in the 73 season by the time the All-Star game was played in July. And so he let Ryan on. And of course, that season, 1973, was when Nolan Ryan broke Sandy Koufax's single season record for strikeouts. He notched 383, besting Koufax by one. And what I think is significant about that record is that Ryan wasn't pitching against pitchers. In other words, he had to face a designated hitter instead of a pitcher, which was kind of an automatic out, and probably would have had at least 20 more strikeouts, maybe 40 more strikeouts if he'd faced pitchers during the season. And so that was kind of the launch pad, I think, for Nolan Ryan's career, that 73 season. And I hold him up as the greatest of all time in terms of being able to throw hard, you know, as hard as today's pitchers, and being able to pitch complete games and throwing seven no hitters and a bunch of near misses. And so I am nostalgic in the sense of I miss when guys would go the whole game as a point of pride. I recognize that guys are throwing harder today and that it makes more sense to nurse their arms and to limit their pitch counts. And there's, you know, the reliever and the specialty relievers have really altered the game. But it adds a little more strategy as well. So I don't complain about that. Obviously, it's lengthened the game with all the pitching changes. But back in 73, the games were 2.5 hours. And that's being held up today as the standard. We want to get back to 2.5 hours. But in 1973, they thought that was too long because they'd been 2 hours, you know, back 20 years prior. So, you know, people always find something to complain about, and the game, of course, will evolve, but there's still always that. Oh, and the other thing, the shift, you know, people are complaining about the shift this year where the teams can't do the shift. I like the shift as a strategic implementation. Now, I wish that the batters would respond by bunting against it or learning to hit to the opposite field. I know that's hard when guys throwing 102 miles an hour or has really nasty stuff.
You don't bunt off the island, John.
Right. But I mean, Rod Carew used to bunt for 30 hits a year, you know? And so I'd go watch him at batting practice. He'd lay out a towel, you know, on the infield, and he'd practice bunting during batting practice. He'd lay balls down and that towel was his target and he'd hit it.
By the way, I thought about this. I think there should be some 388 beer in the Twin Cities. That's what I think.
Really?
Yeah. Because of a Carew hit, right? 388.
That,
right?
Yeah. That was a magical season, 1977. But just one last thing. I mean, in, you know, obviously we've mentioned Ted Williams, teams were employing the shift against him and it worked. And Hank Aaron in 1973, they were managers were employing the shift against him. He had a bad back and he had to adjust his swing so he could no longer hit to the opposite field. Everything he hit was to left field, but so managers employed the shift, and his manager figured it took Matthews figured it had taken about 30 points off of Aaron's band average because he couldn't beat the shift. But, you know, so this wasn't a new recent invention. It's been employed much more frequently over the last decade, but it's, you know, the these things have been around, and, you know, smart move to shift your infield when Hank Aaron's up, and you know he's only going to hit the left field.
1973 season feature. You mentioned that All-Star game at Royal Stadium. You know, you got me Googling stuff and getting my own memories together about things. You mentioned Hank Aaron. I was bragging on the fact that I saw Hank play in 75 as a member of the Milwaukee Brewers as a DH. And my dad specifically took me out to a doubleheader. I've looked up the box score. I fell in love with Sixto Lescano that night. He became my favorite baseball player. So then I had to go see the Brewers every time they came to town until he became a Padre and a Philly. John Rosengren is here. The book is all about 1973 in baseball. It's the greatest summer in baseball history. How the 73 season changes forever. All right, last thought for you, because I don't want to hold you forever here. I know you have other radio things, do books to sell, all that stuff. And that Aparicio Cepeda picture page 202 is priceless. I would say for 73, I've spent 31 years doing this in Baltimore. We lost our football team when I was 17 years old. My dad died pissed at Abe Poland about taking the bullets out of here. We had to go steal a football team. I lived through all the Everett Bennett Williams. The Orioles are going to go to DC. Maybe they are, maybe they aren't. All of that stuff that happened. 73 is interesting to me because I think the DH changed the business of the sport. I think all the things you're talking about with the Players Association and Messersmith that led to the Lords of the Realm being written in 1993, 94, and the strike that happened a generation later. But more than that, as a child, as an Oriole fan who was 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 years old during that late 70s period, how the money and baseball – like 73, everything was about to change. You know, the whole thing where Augie Bush would get even with Steve Carlton by sending him to Philadelphia, sending him to, you know, penal colony to get rid of players. And Frank Robinson and Louis wound up in Baltimore because of just blatant racism. You know, my cousin couldn't get a deal from Vec in Chicago, kind of, you know, hated everywhere he played and was sort of a malcontent, and every piece I've ever read about Louis in the 60s, he's portrayed as a malcontent who was always talking about going back to Venezuela, not coming back. That there was really, and it wasn't just black and Latino players, nobody could get a fair shake from owners, right? So the beast, the anger of these men that played the game, going into Yankee Stadium and seeing it full and realizing that they didn't even have benefits in some cases and had to get summer jobs, that a lot of things changed. And 73 was the beginning of jerks like Reggie Jackson becoming jerks, and stardom and power and money and pay me for my autograph. Like, a lot of that started in that era because these players have been getting screwed for so long.
Right. Well, and it also came along because guys like Finley, of course, were, you know, he'd pinch a penny till Abe Lincoln's nose bled.
He pitched a penny from Kansas City to Oakland and did.
Right. And but then George Steinbrenner came along and bought the Yankees. And, you know, the Mets outdrew the Yankees that year. The Yankees didn't even draw a million fans in 73 because they were so bad. But the Steinbrenner, you know, who famously said, "I'm going to stick to building ships," by the end of spring training had made his team the highest, established his team with the highest payroll of any team in baseball. And of course that trend just continued. And then with free agency, when they were able to spend, you know, lavish amounts, he bought Catfish Hunter and then, gave Catfish Hunter this huge contract. And then, you know, the rest, we know the
story. Well, I remember the wheeling and dealing with Joe Rudy and all the sell-off of the players and Bowie Kuhn right. Stepping in. Like, that was a mess for baseball in the middle of the season.
Exactly. And that came along, I think that was 74 when he tried to sell off all his players, but Kuhn wouldn't let him. But it was really Steinbrenner's willingness to spend the money. And he didn't like spending money, but he had it to spend, and he did spend it because he wanted more than anything to win. And so that infusion of money, you know, made the other owners have to play catch up with him. And again, 73 was the watershed year for that.
John, I appreciate the conversation, and I'm so glad you came on and gave me a chance to pull out my 73. I see the Cepeda autographs two below the Aparicio. I can barely make them out. I feel like I need to have you know, have it CSI glove to try to figure it all out. But great, great memories of my childhood. Great baseball cards. The 74s were better for me than the 73s, my favorites. But anything of that era that makes me think about it, feel it, touch it again, and remember it a little bit, I'm very appreciative. I hope everybody goes out and checks out your book, which was written a number of years ago, but has resurfaced itself with some new
it's
art.
Still fresh today.
Well, yeah. It really did change my love of the game of baseball as we get ready for a year here where it's all Gunnar Henderson and Adley Rutschman, and here we go, Oriole baseball. Luke's going to be covering all things Oriole baseball. You can find him at Baltimore Luke. Dennis will also be around here on Thursdays. Any breaking news as we head into the start of the season, you'll get on the WNST Tech Service, all brought to you by our friends at Coons Baltimore Ford. I am Nestor. We are WNST, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore. Yes, still talking a little baseball here as we roll out the bunting and get ready for Oriole Magic.